Welcome to episode 73 of the Cashflow Connections podcast. The topic for today is developing Class A apartment units in Austin, Texas. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while or paying attention to the real estate sector as a whole, you probably know that Austin has been one of the hottest, if not the hottest market in the U.S. for the last 10 years or so. Not only have they experienced never-before-seen price increases, they've also seen tens of thousands of apartment units coming online simultaneously, and neither of those really look like they're slowing down anytime soon. So what's the story here? Is the market going to be completely oversaturated with 2019 vacant developed units, or is the job market so strong that the units are going to be filled up quickly and the rents are going to continue to increase? Well, today we are joined by someone who is actually from the area and has seen the massive shift take place before their eyes. And they're very bullish on the market still. In fact, they plan on acquiring 4 Class A development projects in 2019. So I wanted to have him on the show and discuss what he's seeing that is suggesting this run-up is still going to continue, has plenty of room. So in discussion, we're going to talk about, first of all, how our guest got connected to Robert Kiyosaki and why he was mentioned in Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Then we're going to talk about some real estate. So we're going to talk about how many units have actually come online in Austin and how the demand can possibly meet that new supply. We're going to talk about why there has essentially been zero Class B development in Austin and why if you're going to develop in that market, you pretty much have to develop Class A. And there's a lot of implications around that that we discuss in a little bit of detail. And of course, we're going to talk about financing. What types of financing are available if you're an experienced developer in the market with some relationships, and what are the implications of that financing? Now, don't forget, mentioned it before, but we have an Instagram now. So if you have an Instagram account, go ahead and give us a follow at Cashflow Connections. You'll get some of the clips of the show on your newsfeed. It's really a teaser for that week's show, just a nice little reminder of some of the big key takeaways of the particular episode of that week. So give us a follow at Cashflow Connections. You'll get that awesome stuff on your newsfeed. All right. Hope you enjoy the episode. How's it going, everyone? Our guest for today is Tom Burns, who is an entrepreneur and an orthopedic surgeon in Austin, Texas. He is currently a physician for the United States ski team and travels worldwide with them. He also has over 20 years of real estate experience involving acquisition, development, and management of traditional multifamily, student housing, office projects, and manufactured housing. In fact, he's participated in the acquisition and development of over $200 million worth of real estate. Dr. Burns is the co-founder and principal of Presario Ventures, which is a private equity real estate company in Austin, and he's also a member of the Forbes Real Estate Council and is listed in the acknowledgement sections of Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is pretty remarkable. So, Tom, thanks again for coming on. We're going to talk about development today. But before we even do that, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time for this conversation.
Great, Hunter. Thanks for having me and glad to be here.
So in that introduction, I cannot help but highlight the fact that I have had the opportunity to interview a lot of really influential people. And I really don't even know how many times Rich Dad, Poor Dad has come up as being one of the driving factors for people thinking about money, thinking about real estate in the way that they do, and that eventually leads them to being interviewed on a show like this. So could you let us know, how were you originally connected with Robert Kiyosaki and how that relationship turned into something where, he was mentioning you in one of his most influential books?
So that book has obviously been transformational. And the story's unique. As it turns out, I am, of the over 40 million books sold worldwide, I bought the very first book.
Whoa.
It's sort of a legendary story. I didn't do anything good. All I did was pick up a great book. But years ago, back in 1997, I was literally, as the story goes, I was actually getting my car washed. And it turns out that Robert's friend had a friend in Austin, Texas, who owned a car wash. Rich Dad, Poor Dad was self-published, and there were 1,000 books printed. And none had sold yet. And so in an effort to potentially get some books sold, Robert sent them to his friend in Austin. The book was originally designed to be a lengthy brochure and an advertisement for the cash flow game. So there was 12 books here in the car wash. I had already been for years, had been kind of learning real estate, reading a lot. I'd read anything that would give me, give me a leg up. And so I was checking out. and looked across the way, and there was this brightly colored book with this purple and gold with a pretty catchy title that said Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I just said, you know, throw one of those on my bill. So took that book home. There was nobody home. My family was gone, which was why I was out running errands. And I did what I needed to do. And I was going to bed about 11:30 at night. And I went past my office where I had dumped the book on my desk. And I just flipped the first page just to see what I was going to read one day. Not that I was planning on reading it at that time. First page was pretty interesting. And I flipped another and read it and sat on the edge of the desk for a little while and read some more. And before I knew it, I had sat down and I had read the entire book in about 4 hours. it was, you know, as and I don't even have to tell you that it's obviously one of the best books I'd ever read. And here it was 3 o'clock in the morning and I had nobody to tell. It's like getting a hole in one on the golf course with nobody watching. I didn't know who to talk to. So at the time I was actually involved in the Amway organization for just a very short time. So I called a guy and I said, look, I just read the best book I've ever read in my life. And he sort of passed me off a little bit, but I gave him the book a few days later. He read it, agreed with me. And we wanted to know who this guy was that wrote this book. So on the inside cover was a phone number, which we assumed was the publisher. So called the phone number and who do you think answered? Robert Kiyosaki answered the phone. And, you know, we kind of talked to him and said, you know, how many of those books you have left? He said, well, I sent a dozen to Austin, so I have 988 left. We said, we'll take them all. So we flew out to Phoenix, met with Robert. He taught us how to play cash flow. We got to be friends. He loaded me with a bunch more books to give out, which I've since given to friends. And, you know, it kind of went from there. And he, because of that association, it got into the multi-level marketing world, starting with Amway. And, you know, that got a few books sold, got him noticed. And then he would talk and speak to large groups. A number of books got sold and eventually Oprah took notice and Robert got on the Oprah show and he'll tell you that that's when things really took off. So hope that story wasn't too long, but that is the real story.
That is actually incredible. And I'm really glad I asked because he obviously can definitely, I didn't know any of that, first of all. Second of all, I could definitely see him being very successful as a speaker. I saw him speak at Freedom Fest this year, and he's very, very compelling. I'm sure that he has tightened his game up considerably since those early days, but I definitely could see that being a factor. And it's pretty fascinating that he originally wrote the book as kind of a pamphlet for the cash flow game. I had never heard that story before. If you guys haven't played that game before, it's really fun to play. I'm not one of the people that plays it every month or has a group for it, but I'll tell you what, when it comes to thinking about money and thinking about real estate, it can be very influential if you're not playing the game already. I mean, wouldn't you say so?
Absolutely. It's a great game. And some people have trouble with it. And it's a mindset game. And he's a teacher, and that's what it's designed for, to teach.
You know, I actually went to a group, Gary Johnston, who has been a guest on this program before. He has a group that meets up and plays that game as part of their seminar that they do because it teaches you the mindset. And this has stuck with me because this is one of the first seminars I ever went to. And I'm very hesitant to go to seminars because of the pitch component and the price points can be pretty crazy. But Gary Johnston's is very inexpensive compared to the level of content that you get. So we were doing this game, and at the end, we went and reviewed the game, and someone said, mentioned a sale that they had made that was clearly a very one-sided sale in the sense that he was taking advantage of someone for not really understanding the implications of the sale that he was doing. And I don't remember exactly how it went down, but they're asking about it, and he said, well, yeah, it was a great deal for me. But the whole point of the game is that that's not the way that you want to play the game. You certainly don't want to play the real estate game like that. And if you're playing in a board game with someone where you have to play with these people, you don't want it to be a one-sided deal. You want to be partners with the people you're playing with so that you can work together. And I think that's one of the crazy things, that it's much better for that person to learn that lesson playing a board game than doing it in real life. And that was just a remarkable cost benefit for me, taking that hour of the time to play that game and learn that lesson the easy way, I would say.
Absolutely. That's the benefit of the game. You know, wealth is mindset and education. You know, the mechanics come and they can be taught, but it's all about mindset and how you think about it. And so to, you know, we get better by making mistakes, and much better to make mistakes on a board game than in real life.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about real estate. What is your current focus? What are the types of deals that you're looking at right now? And what do you find compelling about those deals?
So currently we acquire and develop property in the Class A multifamily space. We have done the Class B space, but our expertise started pretty much back in 2010. We developed our first Class A project, and that went very well. We like that. We like that because we like the debt structure, which we'll talk about later.
Okay.
And so, having been through two recessions, I don't like variable debt. I like to have I like to fix my debt, and I like to fix my taxes if I can. So on that particular deal, we had no taxes and fixed debt for 40 years. So that's part of what we like about these projects. We typically look, you know, as we'll talk about, we look for areas that there's a need. And so we like them because there's longer fixed debt, less deferred maintenance, certainly with the higher end of the demographic. So we're aware that as recession comes, there's going to be some concessions, and those are built into our models. So it's just a niche that we've gotten relatively proficient at. Our investors and our lenders, they sort of know that that's our kind of our shtick. So they bring the deals to us. So that's, we kind of work a different way. Most of the developers and general contractors will bring the deals to us to see if it fits our model. So that's kind of nice.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Especially once you built up that track record. So just give us a couple more details about kind of the bread and butter deals. So in terms of the size, in terms of the market, what are some of the metrics you're looking at to see if it's a good fit for you?
Sure. Well, metric-wise, first we check the market study. And we, you know, first of all, Hunter, we are not in the central business district. We are not, you know, I'm in Austin, Texas. We are not building towers in Austin, Texas. We go out to the edge of town, or we go to secondary markets. It's there that the price points are a bit lower. There's more demand. And so we're looking at secondary markets where growth is coming. We'll look at the market study. Typically our lender, because of the way they work, they have their own market study and will basically tell us that we need property and that we need units in that area. And so go ahead and build your property. Typically we will build about 240 units, usually about $35 to $40 million per project. You know, jobs. We'll talk about that later, but you know, we look at jobs, we look at absorption, we look at supply and demand. And if all those match up well and we can get a reasonable return for our investors, then we will start looking at it deeper.
Okay. And that's definitely a good starting point to give us a framework for which this conversation takes place. How active are you right now? I mean, we've heard incredible things about Austin all over the country. I personally invested in Austin in a variety of different asset classes, but I'm sure that being on the ground is just a completely different level. You've probably seen the city itself change over the last 10 years, just almost unrecognizably.
Oh, it is crazy. You know, I grew up here in Austin, and 30 years ago, we were excited when Austin got mentioned in a national newspaper. Now it's in the top five in everybody's list for everything. It's, you know, it's a place for millennials to live. It's a place to find a job, great place for tech jobs. So I could go through the list. It is very popular. It has gotten more crowded, and there are lots of jobs. You know, our economic incentive program has worked well. We've had 20 years ago, groups from Austin went to Asia, went to various places to entice companies to come here. They have come here. They've liked it. They stay here. And that's why we have such good job growth. So with that has come a lot of residential building downtown. Downtown is a much different skyline than it was in the old days. Austin's still a small town to some, but now it's the 11th largest city in the country. So it's a bit different than when I grew up. Lots of opportunity.
And a lot of that opportunity has been driven by jobs. That's the whole point of the game. And it just a combination of economic incentives that took place that allowed for that, including Texas itself is relatively favorable for businesses. The tax rates are extremely low comparatively to some of the other markets like California in particular. So you're seeing this mass migration of markets like from California to Texas. And then Austin has obviously been the recipient of a lot of that population growth and job growth.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look over the past 10 years at the in-migration to Texas, fully one-third of those people came from California, quite a big chunk from the East Coast and the rest from the Midwest. So there are a lot coming here. And you know, we believe that prices are high here in Austin, but if somebody comes from Silicon Valley or San Francisco, it looks like a deal to them. So that has driven up prices here in Austin. It's tight. So with increasing values has come, of course, more product. So there were a lot of deliveries over the past few years. That train is slowing down a little bit. And despite all the deliveries, the absorption's kept up. And, you know, they see, you know, we had last year, Austin was flat to minus 0.7% rent growth. So it was, you know, it was a flat rent growth year. It's not a high rent growth area.
Because of that additional square footage coming online.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So,
do you have an idea of how significant that was in terms of the number of units or the number of buildings or whatever metrics you use to kind of track that?
I don't have the number handy. It may have been, we may have delivered 14,000 units last year, but I wouldn't bet my mortgage on that.
Something in that range.
Yeah.
Well, with that in mind, what is your current level of activity? I mean, how many deals, if you are breaking ground exclusively and doing ground up development, how many deals did you do in 2018 as opposed to, you know, your most active year since the 2010 time?
2018 we don't shoot for a lot of deals. We shoot for a few quality deals. So our goal was to do 4 projects. And we did two. I'd like to say we did 2.5, but you know, our third one looks like it's going to be Q1 of 2019. So 2 projects, both ground up development, one in San Antonio and one just outside of Austin.
Okay.
So that's what the market gave us.
Got it. And, you know, we did mention some of the big picture metrics that you're looking at just to make sure that the deals make sense. Let's dive in a bit deeper there to talk about, you know, specific underwriting metrics. This is not something, development is not something I have a lot of expertise in, but I'm interested to hear what are some of the rules of thumb, let's say, that you would say, is this going to make sense? Do we need to follow up with the broker or however you're sourcing the deal? And where's that taking on that development risk start to make sense?
Well, you know, we have a model we've developed for acquisition and development. And so, you know, we plug the numbers and, you know, we're looking at 110, 120,000 per unit building costs now. And that's just growing by every quarter. And we have to look at the market and the comps to see if there's going to be a good enough spread from our cost to build to our operating income. So we essentially do it by the numbers. You know, we look at, you know, we know the land costs, and often the land is contributed sometimes by the developer who's already purchased it. Sometimes the GC has bought the land. We'll plug it in, and we essentially plug the numbers in and make sure there's going to be a return for the investor. So to get there, we've got a market study that we perform. We've got a market study that our lender performs, and we will tend to cut those down by about 20% as far as rent growth and absorption, for safety's sake. And if we can get our investors to a reasonable return, we'll start looking back and see if it makes sense for us on the GP side.
Okay. And I guess one of the major metrics that people look at when they want to look at taking on that additional risk is kind of the spread between a purchase price cap rate versus the development cap rate. And I don't know what the exact terminology is. I know return on cost is a metric that is typically used in development sector, but what is that spread that you're seeing between if you would go out and just buy a property now versus taking the 18 months or 24 months to develop a property, the spread between those two different cap rate metrics?
Well, we'd like to see a 200 basis point spread, but I will tell you in this market, we're probably developing to about a 7 to 7.25 cap.
Okay.
And stabilized, we are probably looking at about 5.75 to 6. Now, as we get closer to Austin, that cap rate can drop to 5 and sub 5, but you know, we're in secondary markets. So we're looking often at a 150 basis point spread. That still works well. We prefer 200, but this market's given us about 150.
Okay. Just to clarify that for the listeners, so we kind of went over this, but if you're buying a property outright, which is called a stabilized cap rate, the property is relatively stabilized, they're looking at a property that could maybe be a 7.25% cap rate, or excuse me, a 5.75% cap rate. But in order to get the higher cap rate or to get a more lucrative return, they're willing to develop. That development is based on the assumption that they'll be at a stabilized cap rate at about a 7.25 based on their in-place or the purchase that they're using and the entire cost of doing that. So the honey is that spread between the two. Why you're taking that risk is the spread between those two metrics. One quick question about this, because it obviously makes a big difference. Do you guys go through the entitlement process yourself, or do you typically purchase entitled land that is ready to break ground?
Yeah, good question. Typically, you know, we have done that in the past. In fact, you know, my partner, Darren, still has scars from the last deal.
Yep.
So we've gone through the whole process, been full on, been the developers, developed, syndicated, did it all. These days, we will typically partner with developers. So we catch projects now that are just a little bit farther down the line. They'll have the land purchased, sometimes not entitled, and we'll help them with that. Sometimes they've got the land purchased and entitled, and they need a development partner to help them secure the debt and secure the equity. So we've sort of taken that 6 months of pain and anguish out of at least our timeline.
So as you said that, I have to pick my mouth off the floor, because I was just at a conference talking about Southern California development, and they would have passed out if you said that you can entitle land in 6 months. So when you talk about people moving from California to Texas, that's one of the reasons. Many of the people at the conference were talking about 2 and 3 years, and that's in high quality asset types that is actually demanded by the city. It is remarkable when you just said 6 months. That's pretty surprising. With that in mind, actually, you mentioned Class A. Now, are you seeing it be possible to develop other than Class A, given where prices are in Austin?
No.
Just can't do it.
No. And if you look, development, there is some Class B development, but if you look at a chart of Class A versus Class B, it's the tiniest pie slice you can see. It's just too hard to develop, because construction, you know, lumber is lumber and siding is siding, and you know, the prices are still going to be the same. And so almost every developer that I know, except for a few that I've heard of, are developing the Class A.
Okay. And that's actually a really interesting data point, because this is one of the things with affordable housing. Everyone needs it, nobody wants it, and no one can build it. And so there's just constant squeeze on the middle class and the lower class, because there's less and less housing, and the economics don't make sense to build it. So what you're saying is you get the economies of scale, in the sense that concrete is concrete. You're paying the same for the square footage. If you're going to build the same amount of square footage, you might as well maximize that return by catering it to the Class A type of tenant and getting the higher cost per square foot, which is an interesting data point if you're focusing on affordable, especially in these same markets. I guess the counter argument to that, though, is when the economy turns around and people have to cut costs, it always seems to me that Class A is most exposed, because you can always go down significantly, as opposed to a B or C, where those numbers start to make less and less sense in terms of, you know, cutting costs in terms of housing. So what are your thoughts on the cyclical nature of Class A, despite the fact that Austin has had some really robust income growth?
I agree. Having been here in the 80s and post 2001 and 2008, I painfully recall large banners on the side of apartment complexes that said 3 months free plus a flat screen TV. That's my rallying call to our analysts, you know, when people are assuming rent growth, you know. So that's we will literally build in 5 years of negative 2% rent growth on our sensitivity tables, just to see if the thing will survive. So yes, we know that rents will go down. They get down to a point that some of the people that can possibly have been in a Class B might move up to a Class A. And I think as those waters recede, so do sometimes the Class B rents. I think we're all going to be affected. And so we try to mitigate that by using a certain type of debt product, having fixed debt, and trying to keep the leverage and the debt coverage at a level that we can suffer a big hit and still keep the property functioning while we wait for a hopeful turnaround. And that's our strategy.
Okay, well, let's dive into that for sure, because this is definitely an important part of this conversation, particularly as it relates to development, which is the debt piece. So give us an idea. You mentioned fixed debt, but give us an idea of the entire capital stack during the different stages of development, from breaking ground to being fully stabilized.
So typically, you know, our specialty is government-insured FHA HUD debt. So when you say the word HUD, this is just for your listeners. When you say the word HUD, if you're at a dinner party, everybody thinks, you produce low-income housing. which you can. And a lot of that comes from HUD, but a lot of the nicest apartment complexes that you drive by were financed with HUD debt. So we don't exclusively use that. We will use commercial bank debt, and that's a different structure. That's more for our merchant builds. But if we've got a long-term hold strategy, we will use HUD. And how that works is it's a process. You know, it may take 6 months or more to get that land entitled, but then you get some engineering done, you do your own feasibility study, and you go to HUD and you say, I want to put 240 units right outside of Austin. They will take your data and they'll do their own study and they'll say, no, we have too many properties in that area. We don't think it's going to be worthwhile. Or they'll say, yeah, we like that. We see a deficiency of 800 housing units in that area and you're going to build 240. Go ahead and go to the next stage. So then you go do your full-on engineering. So you're paying for this out of your pocket. You go to another meeting and finally you get to the HUD final endorsement after about 9 months these days. And they will say, you got your loan. So then when you break ground, you have a interest only 2 years of debt through HUD. That should give you enough time to build and at least to build the project and have enough net operating income to cover your debt service. So at month 25, it switches to full amortization. And at that point, you have 40 years of fixed assumable debt amortized at 40 years.
Whoa. Okay. So that's really favorable. I mean, you've seen 20 years in the real estate business. You've seen a lot of cycles. You've seen a lot of debt instruments. How loose or tight would you say this is, and how favorable would you say what you just described is? Because what you just described to me sounds very, very favorable for a lot of reasons.
It is very, and that's why we like the loan product. I mean, it takes a lot of brain damage to get this loan. I mean, it can take you 60 to 90 days to get a commercial bank loan if you've got a good balance sheet. HUD takes some time. They look up your skirt for lack of a better way to say it. They get everything about you. You have to have a certain amount of liquidity, certain amount of strong balance sheet. You can't have had any bad boy things happen to you in the past. And if you mess up once with HUD, you won't get another loan. So you have to really be on your toes. But that brain damage is really worth it in the long run because the properties, they run themselves. It's relatively automatic. HUD requires fairly large reserves. So each month you're building up a large reserve and, you know, you've got a new property. So your deferred maintenance is minimal. You know, one of our properties is 9 years old and we've barely had to use any of our reserves. So if things do go wrong, the money's there. They audit you and the property every year. So there's a third party audit. So that's a safety mechanism for the investors. And it's good for you as the general partner to make sure you're doing things right. And it's fixed. So, you know, in a rising interest rate environment, if you've got something, you know, when our most recent project, we're fixed at the next 41 years at 4.08, fixed all in. Now, that's a pretty good rate. And that's going to be a valuable piece of debt in several years when rates go up. You know, the Fed's talking about one more this year and three more next year, and then maybe standing down. So there's going to be a 200 basis point spread between our debt and the debt that's available in the next year. Another good thing about this particular product is it's assumable. So go on down the line, another person has to go through the underwriting, but for a, you know, small 50 basis point fee, they can assume your loan and just pay you the difference in your equity. So it helps with disposition.
Certainly. And in a rising interest rate environment, especially with the 40-year term, let's talk quickly about how advantageous that can be. So what he's describing is if you have a 4% interest rate and interest rates rise by 200 basis points over the next 40 years, which I think is very reasonable, at that point, the fact that the loan that you're assuming has a 4% interest rate becomes extremely valuable in the sense that you can basically tack that onto the purchase price, meaning that you're going to make a lot more money on the exit. Now, you do have that, let's say, 50 basis point fee or so, but that becomes really advantageous as long as the person that's trying to buy the property can qualify. So I guess the question then is, how challenging is that for them? They obviously need to go through the same thing you went through. So is that buyer pool large enough to make the claim that it will be, you know, most likely able to be assumable? Or what would you think about that?
It's not a big buyer pool, but it's out there. It's there. Okay. There are a lot of people in that world and they search as we do. We'll sometimes do the same thing. We will pick up a property that's near stabilization. And because of our experience with HUD and because they know us, they know that we can execute. So, you know, we can pick up a property like that. There will be others out there. So it's a smaller pool, but it's a heavily vetted pool.
Understood. And it's a small group of people, a lot of which know each other and know of each other because of the place that you're playing in. So obviously, you know, downside protection is the name of the game, especially when it comes to development. It is important to focus on deal structure. We talked about the markets that you're looking in. We talked about the types of debt assets that you're acquiring these properties with. What other things do you do to protect investor capital, whether it be, you know, the structure of the deal or the market dynamics, et cetera?
Well, on a, you know, we do a couple of types of deals. We'll do merchant builds where we build it, stabilize it in 3 years, and you know, hopefully if the market's right, we'll sell that. But on the HUD deals, typically in our model, we'll do standard, similar to a lot of other people, we'll do a preferential return. And we as sponsors typically don't participate in the upside until the investors have their preferential return and their capital back. So we're also in there with our money. So, you know, our best protection is our underwriting. We try to be as conservative as possible. And, you know, always you need 2 or 3 years to look back and see how conservative you really were. But, you know, we are underwriting for our own money as well. So we're riding with them.
You're signing on the loan too. I mean, this circumstance takes a really significant, usually a warm body, as they say. Has that kind of been your experience as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a lot of, now the loans are non-recourse. So we have to go through a lot of trouble to get the loan. But once it's signed, they are non-recourse. So all of us that have our money in the deal, we are basically only liable for the money that we have in the deal. Now, as a general partner and a sponsor, if we blow one, we're never going to get another one. So we are obviously incentivized not to let one ever go bad. And the default rate on HUD projects is 2% over the last 50 years. So it's low.
Because they're vetting the people and the deals accurately, yeah. Obviously.
Exactly. They watch us like hawks. They have multiple mechanisms to make sure that you don't lose your property. And this is what we like going forward into what could be some rocky territory and some rough seas. They will allow you to refinance just to lower your interest rate if the market allows. They'll allow you to refinance and cash out if you wish through another HUD product. And if things actually go really bad, they will come in and they will assess what you can pay. You know, let's say your payment, principal and interest payments, $200,000 and mortgage insurance and all that's $200,000 a month. They'll come in and say, wow, times are rough. You guys are at 80% occupancy. It looks like you can only afford $100,000. So your payment's now $100,000. Now, they don't just throw away that extra $100,000. You've got to pay it back when things get good, but they will let you keep your property. So it's really designed for these properties not to fail and for us to succeed in a good market.
You've mentioned that you've been along the rides of a lot of different market cycles, and I'm interested to hear your perspective on where we are in the current market cycle. Are you concerned? I mean, as a business owner, you may be, you know, excited about a potential, you know, pullback, but as a citizen of the United States, you may be concerned. So what is your thoughts and potential level of concern about where we are in the market?
You know, it's been a great ride. You know, our best project, of course, came out of the ground right when, you know, when smooth water was starting to happen. You know, we came out of the ground in 2010 and life was great. So makes you look really smart. It was just good timing and luck. Now it's been a very long ride. So it doesn't take a brain surgeon to realize that things are going to change. Life is waves and the cycles happen. So I'm cautious. I'm not fearful, but I'm cautious. And absolutely. Going forward, I'm sure you've suggested to your listeners, and I certainly suggest to my investors to keep your money moving as you see prudent, but you know, save some dry powder for when the sale happens. And I tell you that I say that from experience because when the Great Recession came, I thought something was going to happen. Certainly didn't know when it was, but I thought I had all my ducks lined up, and it turned out that some things didn't go quite as well, and I ended up having to pay a lot of investors back out of my pocket due to some variable debts, some guarantees, and some personal loans. And what that did is that cut me out of being a buyer during the early part of the sale. You know, one of the greatest sales in real estate history was occurring at that time, and there was not a lot of cash for me to use to buy for myself. So, you know, I always suggest to people to keep something back in heady times like this. So
certainly. Well, I guess, you know, looking at where we are, do you see anything that is a potential risk? Are you seeing anything that could potentially be a red flag? And if a red flag does come up, what does that look like to you? What do you envision as being a metric that you're saying, okay, now things are getting really scary, it's time to liquidate, you know, we should pause projects? Or is there anything like that that you're seeing on the horizon that potentially make you feel like that?
You know, it's some of the song. You know, remember back in the recession when the old story was, you know, I went to my hairdresser and she was telling me she owned 6 different properties and was buying another one next week, you know?
Right. And she doesn't have a social security number. Right. I remember this.
Exactly. It's a little more sophisticated now, but there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, moving into multifamily. Multifamily has just been hot. You know, I feel good that we started before it was cool, but it's still our industry, and it's, you know, it's a great industry, and there's a reason we chose that, because we expected a recession to come. Multifamily, I think, bought or developed and positioned well, does well through a recession. It's granular enough that it does well through a recession. So I'm worried about, well, I'll give you another example. My analyst is 29 years old, and it took me quite a while to describe to her that 2% rent growth was not necessarily conservative in certain markets. You know, I had to explain to her that 0 and -2 is something you have to put in a sensitivity table. A lot of the people that are investing now have maybe not been around and didn't necessarily live through that recession. So that worries me. And I worry that people will expect that it's always going to go on the way that it has been over the last 8-9 years. Secondarily, and more broadly, you know, I worry about corporate debt. There's a lot of companies out there that are not making a profit. There's a lot of corporate debt. They're riding cheap money right now. And if things, you know, if one thing flips the switch and corporate debt starts to cause a problem for those companies, there could be some job losses. And of course, as we talked about before, jobs affect the multifamily market. And that could be something that could cause a problem for us.
Are you concerned at all, particularly about multifamily, or do you see that as kind of the economy overhaul? In the sense of, multifamily has certainly been able to generate outsized returns for investors for quite some time, even comparably to the other asset classes, which have also killed it. Do you see anything as being a potential risk explicitly for multifamily?
No, I don't think so, really. You know, as you look, there's always overbuilding. Developers are cowboys. You know, they keep riding the horse until it falls. And so usually there's overbuilding. But if you look at the metrics, deliveries are starting to decline. So I think that maybe enough have been burned that they're trying to keep things within the box. Now, of course, interest rates are going to slow things down more. You know, as they grow and grow, if rents can't keep up, we're going to have a lot of difficulty building to a cap rate that's going to make sense.
Right. Well, are you, with that in mind, are you considering any other asset classes, either development or investment?
You know, personally, yeah, I look at everything. I've got office, student, retail, oil property, manufactured housing, and medical real estate. You know, those all have their various areas of safety and security or potential for growth. As a business, we have decided we're going to stick with the multifamily because we believe it might be valuable to have a niche that we're proficient in when things go bad.
Right.
So, and you know, a lot of our equity comes from, you know, East and West Coast, larger sources, you know, not so much syndication, but people that have, you know, have a lot of money that they need to deploy and they understand the long-term nature of it. So we're a smaller company. They like smaller, quote, emerging managers that have muddy boots and dirty hands and stay in the projects. So they'll be searching. There will always be deals, you know, good markets, bad markets. The deal of the century is always right around the corner. You just have to look for it. So we're going to stick in the multifamily world and see if we can stick it out.
Regarding the comment about the deal being right around the corner, what would you say to someone that is considering getting in the space? Let's say there's someone who's relatively new, either a current college student who wants to study real estate or a recent college graduate. What would you suggest for them in terms of the route that they consider to, you know, achieve success as an entrepreneur or otherwise in the real estate development game?
Absolutely. Well, if you specifically want to get into development, first read everything you can, listen to podcasts like yours, just get immersed in the industry. But if you want to learn development and you're just coming out of college, I would strongly suggest go work for a development firm. You know, Robert Kiyosaki says you work to learn, not to earn. So I would learn the ins and outs. And once you've got that knowledge, then you can go out and have your money and your brain work for you. But I would get some education first. It's not something to dive into without without the knowledge and backup.
Yeah, I can second that. The world is filled with developers that had a lot of success over a really short amount of time and then were wiped out forever. You can use leverage and be in the front of a market cycle. And if you do not have the wherewithal and the understanding at an institutional level to know when to slow down, et cetera, or when to exit or how to protect yourself to the downside, you can get destroyed. If you get destroyed once, that might be the last of your development career. So I can't suggest that enough. And I just want to give you an opportunity to say as well, what are some of the books or podcasts? Are there any resources out there that you really like, you know, referring back to the college kid question, you know, that you would suggest?
Absolutely. Well, certainly the Cashflow Connection podcast.
Hey.
You know, this is, you know, this is a very, you know, I tell you, do make that choice easy. This is a really well-informed and well-moderated podcast. You kind of speak to a higher level of investor, and it's really helpful for them. But regarding reading, I read everything. I mean, of course, and, you know, pardon my connection with Robert Kiyosaki, but I tell everybody to read Rich Dad, Poor Dad first and follow it right up with a book called The Cash Flow Quadrant. That is a great 1-2 punch to kind of get somebody to think about money and to think about how they make their money and where they are as far as how they provide their income. There's ways to get wealthy and ways to get in the real estate business, and you can learn it from there. You can at least learn to think about it there. There's, you know, currently, hopefully by about the third quarter of next year, maybe they can read my book. And because I'm developing that, I'm reading some exciting things like Nomi Prinz's book called Collusion.
Great drop. That's a great one.
Yep. And then some things in Ed Griffin's book, Creature from Jekyll Island. So I read those. That's about money. If you want to know the history of money, real estate is great. There are thousands of books out there about real estate and how, you know, there's a lot of how-tos. I'm a big fan of, you know, how-to is great. I'm a big fan of how you think. And, you know, part of how you think is your own personal development. So this is something, you know, I started my life as a physician and, you know, quote, scientist. And it took me a little while to realize that, you know, as you develop, as you change yourself, so does your world change. So, you know, don't shy away about learning a little bit about yourself and about how to work with and for other people. And the more people you serve, the more successful you'll be. So a lot of books to read.
You're not going to get any argument from any of those from me. I mean, those are all really great suggestions. All right, Tom. Well, I appreciate it. Now, before we jump off this call, I wanted to give you the opportunity to let the listeners know how they can learn more about you and your firm.
Oh, you betcha. You can go to our website. It's www.presarioventures.com. That's presarioventures.com. And we've got a newsletter that'll keep you up to date on development and acquisition, primarily in the Class A space. Based on what I just told you, there's also often a few blogs about personal development, how to think, you know, how to help others, that sort of thing. So we kind of hit a couple of things in our newsletter. So it's all out there. It's all free. And we'd love to connect with you.
Awesome, Tom. Well, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Hunter.
All right, listeners, thanks for checking out the episode. As always, the contact information for our guest will be available in the show notes page, which is hosted on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher. Don't forget, if you want access to some of the free goodies that I'm talking about at the beginning of these episodes, like free ebooks, weekly investor emails, and articles about some of the most important investment-related topics, make sure that you have created an account with CFC, because this stuff is automatically available. You can do this by going to cashflowconnections.com and signing up as an accredited investor. Of course, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com. Thanks again.